4. The Monowitz Inmate Infirmary. Camp 4 was opened on the 28th of October 1942, with the arrival of 800 men. The decision to use Auschwitz inmates as workers at the Buna facility in Monowitz involved health concerns that were raised by the SS garrison physician, SS Hauptsturmführer Eduard Wirtz, as early as late 1942. On the 5th of November, SS Obersturmbannführer Enno Lolling, head of Office Group D3, Healthcare and Camp Hygiene, of the SS WVHA, pointed them out to SS Brigadeführer Hans Kammler, head of Office Group C, Construction, in a letter, the text of which I reproduce below in translation, quote, "In order to ensure the complete separation of the Buna camp from the rest of the Auschwitz concentration camp, in the sense discussed on the 4th of November 1942, the infirmary facility in the subcamp proposed by the Auschwitz SS garrison physician is endorsed by us, and it is requested that the construction and furnishing of the infirmary barracks be spurred on from there as far as possible. There are 6 barracks in the Buna camp, 2 surgical, 2 medical and 2 for infectious diseases. The washing and bathing facilities and latrines are still missing in these 6 barracks. These sanitary facilities could be housed in a connecting corridor still to be built between the 2 surgical and medical barracks, as was done at Dachau concentration camp, for example. The surgical barracks still lack a room for aseptic operations. The construction of such a room is absolutely necessary in view of the planned occupancy rate, and to prevent a large number of inmates unable to work. IG Farben is responsible for equipping the surgery room. Latrine, washing and bathing facilities are also required for the barracks for infectious diseases. In order to prevent inmates from contracting lice from the outset, the installation of a disinfestation and delousing facility is urgently required. In connection with this facility, an incinerator and a mortuary could be set up in the basement rooms. It is also pointed out that the above-mentioned facilities are to be regarded as most urgent hygienic medical necessity." Unquote. On the 5th of January 1943, the head of the Central Construction Office, SS Hauptsturmführer Karl Bischoff, sent Kammler a letter with the subject line, "Concentration Camp Auschwitz, Infirmary, Hygienic Installations in Buna Subcamp," in which he stated, quote, "On the basis of the above-mentioned letters, dated the 17th of November and the 18th of December 1942, an inspection of the Buna camp was carried out on the 28th of December 1942, together with the SS garrison physician at Auschwitz, SS Hauptsturmführer Dr. Wirtz. It was determined that the IG construction management had done everything possible so far to improve the camp's hygienic facilities. As can be seen from the enclosed letter, the camp physician has requested various additional hygienic facilities, in addition to those already in place. The IG construction management has promised to do everything in its power to ensure that these requested measures are carried out during the current winter period." Unquote. Attached to the letter were a proposal for a provisional disinfestation chamber, infirmary, Buna subcamp, a proposal for the conversion of the dental ward, infirmary, Buna subcamp, and a proposal for the construction of a lavatory for the quarantine and convalescence block, infirmary, Buna subcamp. The relevant documentation is very sketchy, so it is difficult to explain the attitude manifested by Kammler in the letter to the Auschwitz camp commandant, SS Obersturmbannführer Rudolf Huss, dated the 12th of February 1943, which has as its subject, "Sanitary facilities in the Buna subcamp," quote. "The proposal by SS Obersturmführer Dr. Entriss was brought to my attention by SS Obersturmbannführer Maurer. The establishment of a hospital with an operating theatre, diet kitchen etc., is out of the question. The Buna subcamp is a labor camp. Sick and unfit inmates are to be transferred to the Auschwitz camp, sick SS men to the SS area of the main camp. Only a small area for outpatient treatment was to be maintained. There is also no need to set up a crematorium. In the event of death, the crematorium of the Auschwitz concentration camp is to be used. The permanent presence of a doctor is not required. There was to be consultation hours in the morning and afternoon. This is the procedure in all labor camps." Unquote. These qualms, to some extent, were later overcome. Bernard Wagner outlines the immediately following course of events as follows. Wagner, P. pages 165 and following, quote, "In March 1943, SS physician Horst Fischer was commissioned by garrison physician Wirtz to take over the medical supervision of the Monowitz camp. He was to remedy the unsustainable conditions in view of the economic requirements of IG Auschwitz. During his induction, Wirtz, quote, emphasized the war-related significance of the plant, going so far as to link the importance of this plant with final victory," unquote. Over the next few months, Fischer did indeed set about improving the treatment facilities in Monowitz in order to make the inmates fit for work again more quickly and reduce their mortality rate. End of quote. It is appropriate to outline the general context in which Monowitz inmate infirmary developed. Concerned about the high mortality rate of concentration camp inmates, Himmler wrote the following letter to the head of the SSWVHA on the 15th of December 1942, quote, "Dear Paul, I come back to our conversation in Hegewaldheim. In 1943, try to acquire as many raw vegetables and onions as possible to feed the inmates. During the vegetable season, hand out large quantities of carrots, kohlrabi, white turnips and other such vegetables, and store sufficient quantities for the inmates for the winter, so that they can get enough of them every day. I believe this will considerably improve their state of health. Heil Hitler. Yours, Himmler." Unquote. On the 28th of December 1942, Himmler ordered that the mortality rate of concentration camp inmates be lowered at all costs. On the same day, SS Brigadeführer Gluck sent the concentration camp doctors a letter regarding, quote, "medical activity in the concentration camps," unquote, to which was attached a summary of the changes in camp strength, from which it appeared that, out of 136,000 internees, 70,000 had died. Gluck wrote, quote, "With such a high death rate, the number of inmates can never be brought up to the level ordered by the Reichsführer SS. The head camp physicians must use all means at their disposal to ensure that the mortality rate in the individual camps is significantly reduced. The best physician in a concentration camp is not the one who believes that he must attract attention through inappropriate harshness, but the one who keeps working capacity as high as possible through supervision and exchange at the individual workplaces. The camp physicians have to monitor the inmates' diet more closely than before and, in agreement with the administrators, submit suggestions for improvement to the camp commandants. However, these must not just be on paper, but must be regularly followed up by the camp physicians. Furthermore, the camp physicians must ensure that the working conditions at the individual workplaces are improved wherever possible. To this end, it is necessary for the camp physicians to personally inspect the working conditions at the workplaces. The Reichsführer SS has ordered that the mortality rate must be reduced at all costs. For this reason, the above orders are issued, and monthly reports are to be submitted to the head of office D2. For the first time on the 1st of February 1943. Unquote. On the 20th of January 1943, Gluck returned to Himmler's order by writing the following to all concentration camp commandants, NO 1523, quote, "I am sending the attached copy for your information. As I have already pointed out, every effort must be made to reduce the mortality rate in the camp. This is actually possible through full utilization and tasty preparation of the rations available, and through the well-initiated reception of parcels. I hold the camp commandant and the head of administration of the concentration camp personally responsible for the exhaustion of every possibility to maintain the labor force of the inmates, and for future staff assessments to be submitted here, I will verify whether the responsible SS leaders have also completely fulfilled their duty in this regard." Unquote. As a result of these instructions from Himmler, the mortality rate in the concentration camps was significantly lowered in the first half of 1943. Pohl's relevant report to Himmler, dated the 30th of September 1943, states, PS 1469, quote, "Reichsführer. After the mortality rate was still around 10% in December 1942, it fell to 8% in January 1943, and has steadily declined since. This drop in mortality is mainly attributed to the fact that the hygienic measures that had long been called for were now being implemented, at least to a large extent. Furthermore, in the area of nutrition, it was ordered that one-third of the food be added to the cooked food in its raw state, shortly before serving. Unquote. The other measures concerned improved winter clothing, shorter roll calls, receiving food parcels, and a cooking course in Dachau for inmate cooks. Antoni Makovsky has given a rather detailed picture of the structure and organization of the Monowitz inmate infirmary, but he tends to ascribe to the credit of the inmates what was proposed and carried out by the physicians and SS authorities. I reproduce the salient parts of his description. Makovsky, pages 111-113, quote, "Already in the winter of 1942-43, on the initiative of Wöhrl, a disinfection chamber was organized to disinfect clothes. In the spring of 1943, mainly on the initiative of the new hospital overseer, Stefan Bujaszek, work was begun on the construction of the hospital's baths and washrooms, and the expansion of the rooms of the disinfection section. Here, however, the essential work was the seemingly small, but very important improvement work in blocks 20, 15 and 16, to which washrooms and latrines were added. This was of great importance to the inmates in these sections, because until then, they had to carry out their bodily needs in primitive buckets. At the same time, work was undertaken to build an operating room attached to block 18, as well as a preparation room. Because of the conditions in the camp, this room was very well built, had a concrete floor as smooth as possible, a few wash basins with running water, and an operating lamp above the operating table. In block 19, a room was set up for clean, meaning aseptic operations. It was a spacious room, with single beds, with insulation under an insulated ceiling, as opposed to the normal roof of a barracks. All this work was for the most part finished in the fall of 1943, but improvements of individual rooms, auxiliary wards, nurses' living sections, etc., lasted until the end of the camp's existence." Unquote. Makovsky then lists the hospital's most important departments, Ibidem, page 114, quote, "1. Bathroom with hot water in the bathtubs and showers, where all sick people arriving at the hospital bathed. 2. Disinfection, meaning disinfestation section of clothes, attached to the well-functioning bathroom. 3. Food stores, in which food was distributed to the various wards of the hospital. 4. Hospital kitchen, where coffee was prepared. 5. Small vegetable garden around the hospital." Unquote. About the kitchen, Makovsky adds, Ibidem, pages 119 and following, quote, "In mid-1943, a small kitchen was built in the hospital, in which coffee was prepared in the morning and evening, and periodically the soup of the dietary regimen, which ensured that the dietary patient had sufficient fluids to drink, which reduced the inconvenience of resorting to the main kitchen. In the hospital's kitchen and warehouse, the distribution of food for the various blocks or wards took place. Nurses, under the supervision of the head warder, distributed food there to the sick and staff. Thanks to this proper choice and constant supervision, this distribution at the hospital was generally carried out conscientiously and justly. For the most seriously ill patients, with digestive tract disorders after surgeries, the hospital received 50 rations of diet food from the main camp kitchen, instead of ordinary soup, whole grain bread and bread supplements, half a liter of milk soup with added semolina, sugar and 200 grams of white bread. From time to time, the hospital received some sugar and oatmeal, which was distributed to the convalescents in the form of a dry mixture. For some sick people, the food parcels they received from their families were an essential supplement to their diet. Other inmates also benefited, with whom the recipients of the parcels shared their contents, or gave them their own ration of camp soup. The hospital staff received an additional half liter of regular or diet soup." Unquote. Makovsky summarizes in a table, as reproduced in the e-book and print edition of this book, the development of the various hospital sections in chronological order, Ibidem, page 112. Missing here, however, is the X-ray station, which was undoubtedly established in 1944, the date is unknown, attested to both by testimony and by a photo of the existing X-ray device that was introduced as evidence during the IG Farben trial, Eidefeld's defense counsel. In February 1946, two former Italian Auschwitz inmates, the famous author Primo Levi and Leonardo de Benedetti, wrote a, quote, report on the hygienic sanitary organization of the Monowitz concentration camp for Jews, Auschwitz, Upper Silesia, unquote, which I reproduce below in its entirety because of its importance. Leonardo de Benedetti was born in Turin on the 15th of November 1898. In 1938, as a result of racial laws, he lost his post as medical officer. On the 3rd of December 1943, he was interned in the Fossili concentration camp, from where he was deported to Auschwitz on the 22nd of February 1944, and registered there with the inmate number 174,489. In Monowitz, he was not employed as a doctor, but he had the opportunity to get to know the inmates' hospital well, as a patient, as he was admitted there three times, for a total of 129 days, as I will document below. The original text of the report, which was published in the journal Minerva Medica, Volume 2, Number 47. The 24th of November 1946, pages 535 to 544, with minor changes, mainly stylistic in nature, is followed by an account by Primo Levi, titled, Story of 10 Days, which bears his signature and the date February 1946 at the end. Quote, report on the hygienic sanitary organization of the Monowitz concentration camp for Jews, Auschwitz, Upper Silesia. Dr. Leonardo de Benedetti, physician, surgeon. Dr. Primo Levi, chemist. Through photographic documents, and now numerous reports provided by former internees of the various concentration camps, created by the Germans for the annihilation of the Jews of Europe, perhaps there is no longer anyone who is still unaware of what those places of extermination were, and what nefarious deeds were carried out there. However, in order to make better known the horrors that we too witnessed, and often fell victim to during the period of 1 year, we believe it is useful to make public in Italy, a report that we submitted to the government of the USSR, at the request of the Russian headquarters of the Katowice concentration camp for former Italian inmates. We were also lodged in this camp after our liberation, which took place by the Red Army in late January 1945. Let us add here, to that report, some general news, since our report at that time was supposed to deal exclusively with the operation of the health services of the Monowitz camp. Similar reports were requested by the same Moscow government, from all those doctors of all nationalities, who had been equally liberated from other camps. We had left the Fossili concentration camp in Carpi, Modena, on the 22nd of February 1944, with a convoy of 650 Jews of both genders and all ages. The oldest was over 80 years old, the youngest was a three-month-old infant. Many were ill, and some seriously so. One old man in his 70s, who had suffered a brain hemorrhage a few days before departure, was likewise loaded onto the train, and died during the journey. The train consisted only of cattle cars, locked from the outside. In each car were crammed more than 50 people, most of whom had brought with them as much as they could of their suitcases, because a German marshal, in charge of the camp at Fossili, had suggested to us, with the air of giving dispassionate and affectionate advice, that we should provide ourselves with a lot of heavy clothing, sweaters, blankets, furs, because we would be taken to countries with a harsher climate than ours. And he had added, with a benevolent smile and a wry wink, that, if anyone had hidden money or jewelry with him, he would do well to bring those too, which would certainly come in handy up there. The majority of those who departed had taken the bait, accepting an advice that was nothing but a vulgar trap. Others, very few, had preferred to entrust some private person, who had access to the camp, with their belongings. Again others, who at the time of their arrest had not had time to provide themselves with clothing, left with only the clothes they were wearing. The journey from Fossili to Auschwitz lasted exactly 4 days and was very painful, especially because of the cold, which was so intense, especially at night, that in the morning, the metal pipes that ran inside the wagons were covered with ice, due to the condensation on them of the water vapor of the exhaled air. Another torment, that of thirst, which could not be quenched, except with the snow collected at that one daily stop, when the convoy stopped in the open country, and travelers were allowed to disembark from the wagons, under the very close surveillance of numerous soldiers, ready, with their machine guns always leveled, to fire on those who hinted at moving away from the train. It was during this brief stop that food was distributed, bread, jam and cheese, never water or any other drink. Sleeping possibilities were reduced to a minimum, since the quantity of suitcases and bundles of all kinds, shapes and volumes cluttering the floor did not allow anyone to settle down in a comfortable position suitable for rest, but each traveler had to be content to remain curled up, at the least in a very small space. The floor of the wagons was always wet, and not even a bit of straw had been provided to cover it. As soon as the train reached Auschwitz, it was about 9 p.m. on the 26th of February 1944, the wagons were quickly cleared out by several SS men, armed with pistols and equipped with clubs, and the travelers were forced to lay suitcases, bundles and blankets along the train itself. Then the party was instantly divided into three groups, one of young and apparently fit men, of which 95 individuals came to be a part, a second of women, also young, a small group of only 29, and a third of children, invalids and the elderly. And while the first two were sent separately to different camps, there is reason to believe that the third was led directly to the Birkenau gas chamber, and its members were slaughtered on the same evening. The first group was taken to Monowitz, where there was a concentration camp administratively dependent on the Auschwitz center, from which it was about 8 kilometers away, and which had been established in mid-1942, for the purpose of supplying labor for the construction of the Bunawerke industrial complex, dependent on the IG Farben industry. It housed 10,000 to 12,000 inmates, although its normal capacity was only 7,000 to 8,000 men. Most of these were Jews of every nationality in Europe, while a small minority were German and Polish criminals, Polish politicals and saboteurs. The Bunawerke, intended for the large-scale production of synthetic rubber, synthetic gasoline, dyes and other coal products, occupied a rectangular area of about 35 square kilometers, one of the entrances to this industrial zone, all fenced off by high barbed wire fences, was a few hundred meters from the Jewish concentration camp, while a short distance from it, and adjacent to the periphery of the industrial zone, stood a concentration camp for British prisoners of war, and farther away, there were other camps for civilian workers of various nationalities. Incidentally, the production cycle of the Bunawerke was never started. The inauguration date, first set for 1944, was gradually postponed due to aerial bombardment and sabotage by Polish civilian workers until the evacuation of the territory by the German army. Monowitz was thus a typical Arbeitslager, labor camp. Every morning, the entire population of the camp, except for the sick and the few personnel engaged in internal work, marched in perfect rank and file, to the sound of a band playing military marches and cheerful ditties, to go to their workplaces, distant for some teams as much as 6 or 7 kilometers. The road was traveled at a very rapid pace, almost at a run. Before leaving for work and after returning from it, a roll call ceremony took place daily on a special square in the camp, where all inmates had to stand at attention from 1 up to 3 hours in any weather. As soon as they arrived at the camp, the group of 95 men was led into the disinfection barracks, where all its members were promptly made to undress, and then subjected to a complete and thorough shaving. Hair, beards and every other hair fell rapidly under scissors, razors and shears. After that, they were ushered into the shower room, and locked up there until the following morning. They, tired, hungry, thirsty, sleepless, stupefied by what they had already seen, and worried about their immediate future, but worried above all about the fate of their loved ones, from whom they had been brutally and abruptly separated a few hours earlier, with their minds tormented by dark and tragic forebodings, had to spend the whole night standing, their extremities in the water that was dripping from the pipes and ran across the floor. Finally, at about 6 o'clock the next morning, they were subjected to a general rubbing with a Lysol solution, and then to a hot shower, after which they were given their camp clothing, but to get dressed, they were sent to another room, which they had to reach from outside the barracks, coming out naked in the snow and still wet. In the winter season, the inmates' clothing at Monowitz consisted of the following: a jacket, a pair of pants, a cap and a coat of striped cloth, a shirt, a pair of cloth underpants and a pair of ankle gaiters, a sweater, and a pair of wooden-soled boots. Many of the ankle gaiters and many of the underpants had evidently been obtained from some tallit, the sacred shawl with which Jews used to cover themselves during prayers, found in the suitcases of some deportee, and used in that guise as a sign of contempt. As early as April, when the cold weather, though mitigated, had not yet disappeared, thick clothing and sweaters were withdrawn, and pants and jackets replaced with similar light garments, also with stripes, and only towards the end of October was winter clothing distributed once more. This, however, did not happen again in the fall of 1944, because thick suits and coats had reached their extreme end of usability, so that the inmates had to face the winter of 1944-45 dressed in light cloth, as during the summer months, only a small minority received some light gabardine raincoats or a sweater. It was strictly forbidden to possess spare clothing or underwear, so that it was practically impossible to wash shirts and underwear. These garments were changed by authority at intervals of 30 to 40 to 50 days, according to availability and without having a choice. The new garments were not cleaned, but only steam disinfected, because there was no laundry in the camp. It consisted mostly of short underpants and shirts, always made of canvas or cotton, often sleeveless, always repulsive in appearance because of the numerous stains of all kinds, often torn to shreds. Sometimes, in their place, one received a jacket or pajama pants, or even a few pieces of women's underwear. Repeated disinfections deteriorated the fabrics, removing all durability from them. All this material represented the shoddiest part of the linen, removed from the components of the various transports that flowed, as is known, continuously to the Auschwitz center from all parts of Europe. Coats, jackets and pants, both summer and winter, were distributed in an incredibly bad state of preservation, full of patches and soaked in filth, mud, machine oil, paint. Inmates were required to make repairs themselves, with neither thread nor needles being distributed for anything. Exchanging items was extremely difficult, and possible only when any attempt at repair was patently impossible. Ankle gaiters were not exchanged at all, but their renewal was left to the initiative of each individual. Owning handkerchiefs or otherwise any rag was forbidden. Boots were made in a special workshop that existed in the camp. Wooden soles were nailed to uppers of leather or leather-like, or canvas and rubber from the shoddiest footwear, obtained from incoming convoys. When they were in good condition, they constituted a fair defense against cold and dampness, but they were totally unsuitable for even short marches, and were a cause of erosion of the skin of the feet. One could count oneself lucky when coming in possession of boots that were the right size and matched. When deteriorated, they were repaired countless times, beyond all reasonable limits, so that new shoes were very rarely seen, and those commonly distributed did not last more than a week. Shoelaces were not distributed, they were replaced by each individual with pieces of twisted paper rope or electric wire, when it was possible to find any. The sanitary state of the camp appeared at first glance to be really good. The lanes and alleys separating the different blocks were well kept and clean, as far as the muddy roadbed allowed, the outside of the blocks in well-painted wood, and the inside with the floors carefully swept and washed every morning, with the so-called three-story castles in perfect order, and the bedding blankets well spread out and smoothed. But all this was but appearance, the substance was quite different. In fact, in the blocks that should normally have accommodated 150 to 170 people, there always lived no less than 200, sometimes even 250, so that almost in each bed, two people had to sleep. Under these conditions, the volume of the dormitory was certainly less than the minimum required by the needs of respiration and blood oxygenation. The bedsteads were equipped with a kind of sack, more or less filled with wood shavings, reduced almost to dust by long use, and two blankets. Apart from the fact that these were never changed and did not undergo any disinfection, except rarely and for exceptional reasons, they were mostly in a very poor state of preservation, worn out from very long use, torn, covered with stains of all kinds. Only the most prominent bedsteads had apparently decent and almost clean and sometimes even beautiful blankets. These were the bedsteads on the lower floors and closest to the front door. Of course, these beds were reserved for the little hierarchs of the camp, squad leaders and their assistants, aides of the block eldest, or simply friends of this or that personage. This explains the impression of cleanliness and order and hygiene received by anyone who, entering the dormitory for the first time, glimpsed its interior with a superficial glance. In the scaffolding of the castles, in the support beams, in the bedding boards lived thousands of bedbugs and fleas that made the inmates' nights sleepless. Nor were the disinfections of the dormitories with hydrogen cyanide vapors, practiced every 3 or 4 months, sufficient for the destruction of those guests, which continued to thrive and multiply almost undisturbed. On the other hand, a thorough fight was waged against lice in order to prevent a typhus epidemic every evening after returning from work, and more strictly on Saturday afternoons, devoted among other things to shaving the hair, beard and sometimes other hair, a so-called lice check was practiced. Each inmate had to strip naked and submit his clothing to the meticulous examination of specially appointed officers. And if even a single louse was found on a deportee's shirt, all the personal clothing of all the inhabitants of the dormitory was promptly sent for disinfection, and the men were subjected to Lysol disinfection, followed by showering. They then had to spend the entire night naked, until the early hours of the morning, when their clothing, soaked in moisture, was brought back from the disinfection barracks. However, no other measures were being put in place against contagious diseases, which also were not lacking: typhoid and scarlet fever, diphtheria and chickenpox, measles, erysipelas, etc., not to mention the numerous contagious skin infections, such as dermatophyte infections, impetigo, and scabies. Is it really any miracle that, given so much neglect of hygienic standards in such a high density of people, rapidly spreading epidemics have never broken out? Another possible cause of transmission of infectious diseases was the fact that a fair percentage of inmates were not provided with a bowl or spoon, so that it happened that three or four people were forced to eat successively from the same receptacle, or with the same cutlery, without having the opportunity to wash them. The food, insufficient in quantity, was of poor quality. It consisted of three meals: in the morning, immediately after waking up, 350 grams of bread was distributed four times a week, and 700 grams three times a week, thus a daily average of 500 grams, a quantity that would have been fair, if the bread itself had not unquestionably contained a very large amount of slag, among which, very visible, was wood sawdust. In addition, also in the morning, 25 grams of margarine with about 20 grams of salami or a spoonful of cottage cheese or jam. Margarine was only distributed 6 days a week. Later, this distribution was reduced to 3 days. At noon, the deportees received a liter of a turnip or cabbage soup, absolutely tasteless because of the lack of any seasoning, and in the evening, at the end of work, another liter of a somewhat more substantial soup, with a few potatoes or sometimes with peas and chickpeas, but even this was totally devoid of fatty seasonings. Rarely some pieces of meat could be found in it. As a drink, half a liter of an infusion of an ersatz coffee, unsweetened, was distributed in the morning and evening. Only on Sundays was it sweetened with saccharin. There was a lack of potable water in Monowitz. The water from the washrooms and showers must have been for external use only, since it was river-derived, and arrived at the camp unfiltered and therefore highly suspect. Its appearance was clear, although, seen in a thick layer, yellowish in color, its taste between metallic and sulfuric. Inmates were forced to shower once to twice a week, and in some blocks even three times, but such cleanings were not enough to keep a person clean, since the distribution of soap was made in very sparing quantities. Only once a month, soap was distributed in the measure of a 50-gram bar of soap. Its quality was very bad. It was a rectangular-shaped piece, very hard, devoid of fatty substances, rich instead in sand, which did not foam and crumbled very quickly, so that after a couple of baths, it was completely consumed. After the bath, there was no possibility of rubbing one's body or drying it, because there were no towels, and after leaving the bath, one had to run naked, whatever the season, whatever the weather and the temperature, to one's block, where one had deposited one's clothing. The jobs to which the great majority of the inmates were assigned were manual labor, and all of them very strenuous, unsuited to the physical condition and ability of the condemned. Very few of them were employed in jobs that had any affinity with the profession or trade exercised during civilian life. Thus, neither of the undersigned was ever allowed to work in the hospital or in the chemical laboratory of the Bunarwerke, but both were forced to follow the fate of their comrades, and had to submit to labors beyond their capabilities, now working as earthworkers with pick and shovel, now as unloaders of coal or cement sacks, or in yet other ways, all of them very heavy, jobs that naturally took place outdoors, in winter or summer, in the snow, in the rain, in the sun and wind, without sufficient protection of clothing against low temperatures and bad weather. Such work then always had to be performed at a brisk pace, without any break, except that of 1 hour, from noon to 1 o'clock, for the meal. Woe to him who was caught loitering or in a resting attitude during working hours. From the quick description we have given of the way of life in the Monowitz concentration camp, it is easy to deduce what were the most frequent diseases by which the inmates were afflicted, and their causes. They can be classified into the following groups. 1. Dystrophic diseases, 2. Diseases of the gastrointestinal tract, 3. Cooling diseases, 4. General infectious and skin diseases, 5. Surgical diseases, 6. Work-related illnesses. Dystrophic diseases. The diet which, as we have seen, was far below requirements quantitatively seen, was lacking in two important qualitative factors. It lacked fats and especially animal proteins, except for those paltry 20 to 25 grams of salami, which were given 2 or 3 times a week. There was also a complete lack of vitamins. This therefore explains how so many food deficiencies were the starting point of those dystrophies, which affected almost all inmates from the first weeks of their stay. Indeed, all of them lost weight very rapidly, and most of them had skin edema, localized especially in the lower limbs. However, there was no lack of facial edema. Similarly, in charge of these dystrophies could be put the ease with which the various infections, especially those of the cutaneous apparatus, were contracted, and their tendency to become chronic. Thus, certain erosions of the skin of the feet, directly caused by footwear, anti-physiological in their shape and size, furuncles, very frequent and numerous on the same individual, ulcus cruris, equally frequent, flemens, which showed no tendency to heal, but turned into torpid lard-bottomed sores, with interminable purulent serous suppurations, and sometimes with an exuberance of yellowish-gray granulations, which were not revived, even by brushings of silver nitrate. And finally, a not insignificant part of diarrhea, by which almost all inmates were affected, was equally to be attributed to nutritional dystrophy. Thus, this explains how the deportees quickly lost their strength, since the melting of the panniculus adiposus was accompanied by the establishment of considerable atrophy of the muscular tissues. At this point, we must mention avitaminosis. From what we have said so far, it would seem obvious that avitaminotic syndromes, and particularly from vitamin C and vitamin D deficiency, were frequent. Instead, we are not aware of any cases of scurvy or polyneuritis, at least in a typical and complete form, and this we believe in relation to the fact that the average period of life spent by the majority of the deportees was too short for the organism to have time to manifest obvious clinical signs of suffering from the lack of those vitamins. Diseases of the gastrointestinal tract. We neglect here those diseases by which many inmates were afflicted, and which were not in strict dependence on the modalities of life in the camp, such as hypo and hyperchlorohydriae, gastroduodenal ulcers, appendicitis, enterocolitis, and liver disease. We only recall how these pathological states, pre-existing in many deportees before their entry to the camp, were aggravated or represented relapses, if antecedently cured. Here, we especially want to mention diarrhea, which we have already mentioned in the previous section, both because of its prevalence and the severity of its course, many times rapidly fatal. It mostly erupted suddenly, sometimes preceded by dyspeptic disorders, as a result of some occasional cause, which was the accidental determinant, such as, for example, prolonged exposure to cold, or the intake of spoiled food, sometimes bread was moldy, or of difficult digestion. It is worth mentioning in this regard, how many inmates, to calm hunger pangs, ate potato peels, raw cabbage leaves, rotten potatoes, and turnips that they picked up among the kitchen waste. But it is likely that multiple other factors lay at the root of severe diarrheas, and two especially, interdependent ones, chronic dyspepsia and the resulting nutritional dystrophy. Those affected presented numerous excrement discharges, from a minimum of 5 to 6, up to 20 and perhaps more per day, liquid, preceded and accompanied by vivid abdominal pain, very rich in mucus, sometimes mixed with blood. Appetite could be preserved, but in many cases, patients presented with stubborn anorexia, whereby they refused to feed. These were the most severe cases, rapidly evolving to a fatal outcome. Very intense thirst always existed. If the disease tended toward recovery, the number of discharges decreased, dwindling to 2 to 3 a day, while the quality of the stools changed, turning them into pultaceous. Patients always emerged from this diarrheal disease with a noticeable aggravation of their general condition, and with a more pronounced apparent slimming, due to severe tissue dehydration. The standard treatment was of a dual nature, and encompassed both nutrition and pharmacological therapies. After their admission to the hospital, the patients underwent a total fast for 24 hours, after which they received a special diet, until their condition improved discernibly, and the number of bowel movements had declined, the stools had become firm, and the prognosis became clearly favorable. For this regimen, the sausage ration as well as the soup was eliminated from lunch, white bread substituted for whole grain bread, and for supper, there was a very nutritious sweet semolina soup. Further, the doctors ordered the patients to take little, or best of all, no liquids, although the morning and evening doses of coffee were not reduced by the administration. The pharmacological treatment consisted of 3 or 4 Tanalbin pills and the same number of activated carbon tablets. In severe cases, the patients also received 5 drops of tincture of opium each day, as well as some drops of cardiazol. Cooling diseases. Prolonged daily exposures to cold and weather, against which the inmates were by no means protected, and to humidity, explain the frequency of rheumatic diseases affecting the respiratory system and joints, neuralgias and frostbite. Bronchitis, pneumonia, bronchopneumonia were, it can be said, the order of the day, even during the summer season, but, as is natural, they were particularly raging during autumn, winter and spring. They were treated very simply: cold compresses on the chest, a few antipyretic tablets and, in the most severe cases, sulfur drugs in absolutely insufficient doses, at best, a little cardiazol. Against neuralgia, especially frequent lumbago and sciatica, and against arthritis, the sick were subjected to heat irradiation. Against frostbite, no treatment was practiced, except for amputation of the diseased part, when the frostbite was of a certain severity. Infectious diseases. The most frequent of these were exanthematous diseases, and especially scarlet fever, chickenpox, diphtheria and erysipelas. Cases of abdominal typhoid fever also occurred occasionally. Those who were affected by one of these infections were admitted to an isolation ward, but in a promiscuous manner, since there was no separation between the different chronic forms. It was therefore very easy for one, who entered the infirmary with one morbid form, to contract the contagion of another, all the more so, since neither the bed covers nor the bowls, in which the soup was distributed, were ever disinfected. Scarlet fever and erysipelas were fought with sulfur drugs, administered, however, in small doses. Diphtheria patients were left to their own devices, because of the absolute lack of serum, and their treatment was limited to gargling a very dilute solution of quinosol, and administering tablets of panflavin. This makes it understandable how the mortality rate from diphtheria reached 100%, as those who made it through the acute period succumbed later to cardiac paralysis or some other complication, or the superimposition of another morbid form. As for syphilis, tuberculosis and malaria, we are unable to report anything particular about their frequency, since lewitic, tuberculosis and malaria sufferers, the latter even if cured long ago and accidentally discovered by their confession, were undoubtedly sent to Birkenau, and then murdered in the gas chamber. It cannot be denied that this was a radical prophylactic method. Affecting the integument, infections of all kinds were very common, but particularly furuncles and abscesses, which, as we have already reported, had a very prolonged course and was subject to relapse, with multiple simultaneous localizations, beard siccuses and trichophytes. Against the former, only surgical treatment was practiced, with incision and drainage of the foci, lacking the possibility of stimulotherapy with vaccine or chemotherapy treatments. Only in the most stubborn cases were patients given autohemotherapy. Against the latter, psychosis and trichophagia, there were no specific remedies, and especially no iodine. The faces of the sick were smeared with some of the few ointments available, whose therapeutic effect was little more than nil. Faced with the ever-increasing spread of these dermatoses, they ended up on the one hand taking prophylactic measures, such as forbidding the sick to have their beards shaved, to prevent the transmission of infection by means of razors and brushes, and on the other hand, they intensified treatment by subjecting the sick to ultraviolet radiation. the most severe cases of psychosis then were temporarily transferred to the Auschwitz hospital to undergo X-ray therapy. Affecting the skin, we must also mention the spread of scabies, which was treated with a daily rub of Mitigal in a special barracks, where the sick were admitted only in the evening, to spend the night, while during the day, they had to continue their work regularly in the squad, to which they were assigned. That is, there was no special commando for scabiosis, to which the infested were attached for the duration of the illness. Therefore, as they continued to work among individuals who were not yet infested, transmissions were very frequent, due to the common use of tools and the close commonality of life. Surgical diseases. Here again, we do not want to linger on those ailments that required surgery, but were not in a dependent relationship with camp life. We only report that even high surgery, mainly abdominal, such as gastroenteroanastomosis for gastroduodenal ulcers, appendectomies, rib resections for empyemas, etc., etc., and orthopedic surgeries for fractures or dislocations were routinely performed. If the patient's general condition did not give sufficient guarantees for his or her resistance to operative trauma, he or she was given blood transfusions before surgery. These were also performed to combat anemia, secondary to severe bleeding from gastric ulcers or accidental trauma. As blood donors, some deportees, recently arrived and still in good general condition, were used. The offering of blood was voluntary, and the donor was rewarded with 15 days' rest in the hospital, during which he received special food, so blood donors were always numerous. We are not aware in any way, and indeed we believe we can rule it out, that operations for the purpose of scientific research, such as were carried out on a large scale in other concentration camps, were practiced in the Monowitz camp hospital. We know, for example, that in Auschwitz, a department of that hospital was used for research into the effects of castration and the subsequent grafting of heterosexual glands. The surgical room was fairly well stocked with instrumentation, at least as much as was sufficient for the surgeries being performed. Its walls were lined with white washable tiles. There was an articulating surgical couch, of a somewhat old model, but nevertheless in good condition, and allowing the patient to be placed in the main operating positions, an electric stove for sterilizing the irons, and lighting was provided by a few movable spotlights and a large fixed central chandelier. Set into one wall, behind a wooden screen, were hot and cold running water sinks for cleaning the hands of the surgeon and his assistants. On the subject of aseptic surgery, let us recall that hernias were also regularly operated on at the request of the sick, at least until mid-spring of 1944. From this time on, such operations were discontinued, except for very rare cases of strangulated hernias, even if they were voluminous hernias and truly embarrassing for work, and this was on the assumption that the sick underwent the operation with the purpose of procuring a month's rest in the hospital. The most frequent interventions were Flemons, which were operated on in the special barracks of septic surgery. Flemons constituted, next to diarrhea, one of the most important chapters of the particular pathology of the concentration camp. They were located mainly in the lower limbs, with other locations being rarer. Usually, one could recognize their starting point in some skin lesion of the feet, caused by footwear, erosions, at first superficial and of limited extent, becoming infected or enlarged with peripheral and deep infiltration, or causing metastatic infiltration at some distance. But sometimes, the point of entry of the pathogenic germs could not be identified, the soft tissue infiltration formed, without any skin lesion being detectable in its vicinity or at a distance. It was in all probability a cutaneous localization of germs that had started from some focus and had been transported with the bloodstream. The sick were operated on early, with multiple generous incisions, but the subsequent evolution of the lesions was always very long, and the incisions, even when suppuration drew to a close, showed no tendency to heal. Postoperative care consisted of simple drains of the surgical wound. No therapy was implemented to stimulate organic defenses. Relapses were therefore very easy, and therefore, serial operations on the same individual, to open and drain the pockets of pus that formed at the periphery of the previous incisions, were frequent. When the healing process finally showed that it was well advanced, the sick were discharged from the hospital, although the wounds were not yet completely sealed, and the patient started to work again, and further dressings were performed on an outpatient basis. it is logical that most of those discharged in such a condition would, after a few days, have to return to the hospital, either because of local relapses or the formation of new outbreaks elsewhere. Acute otitis was also very common, with a singularly high percentage of mastoid complications. These were also regularly operated on by the otolaryngologist specialist. The treatment of skin infections was based on the use of four ointments, which were used successively in a standardized manner, according to the stage of the lesions. At first, in the stage of infiltration, the lesion and the surrounding region were covered with ichthyol ointment for resolving purposes. Later, when the fusion had occurred and the focus was open, the bottom was covered with Collagol ointment for disinfectant purposes. Until suppuration ceased or greatly diminished, palidal ointment was used as a cicatrizant, and finally zinc oxide ointment was used as an epithelizer. Work-related diseases. Given the particular employment of the masses in general labor, it does not appear that any particular occupational diseases occurred, if we exclude surgical ones from accidents, namely, fractures and dislocations, but we can report on one case to our knowledge. At one time, August 1944, the men assigned to the so-called chemical command were assigned to rearrange a warehouse containing sacks of a substance of a phenolic nature. Already on the first day of this work, this substance, in fine powder form, adhered to the faces and hands of the workers, retained there by sweat. Subsequent exposure to the sun caused in everyone, first an intense pigmentation of the exposed parts, accompanied by intense burning, then extensive desquamation in wide lamella. Although the new epidermal layer, which was thus exposed to the irritant, was particularly sensitive and sore, the work was continued for 20 days without any protective measures. And although all the men of said unit, about 50, were affected by this painful dermatitis, none of them was hospitalized. Having thus reviewed the most frequent illnesses in the Monowitz camp and their causes, we must confess that it is not possible for us to report precise data in absolute and relative figures on their frequency, since neither of us ever had the opportunity to enter the hospital, except as a sick person. What we have written and what we will still say is the fruit of daily observation and the news we accidentally or unintentionally learned, conversing with comrades, doctors, and hospital staff, with whom we were on friendly or acquaintance terms. The camp hospital had been established only a few months before our arrival in Monowitz, which was in late February 1944. Prior to that time, there was no medical service, and the sick had no chance of treatment, but were forced to work equally every day, until they fell exhausted on the job. Of course, these cases were very frequent. It then happened that the ascertainments of death were made by a singular system. Two individuals, not doctors, were in charge of them, who, armed with nerves of steel, had to beat the fallen person for several minutes at a time. At the end, if he did not react with any movement, he was considered dead, and his body was immediately transported to the crematorium. If, on the other hand, he moved, it meant that he was not dead, and therefore he was forced to resume the interrupted work. Later, the first nucleus of a medical service was created with the establishment of an outpatient clinic, where anyone could present himself for examination, if he felt ill. If, however, anyone was not recognized by the doctors as ill, he was immediately punished by the SS with severe corporal punishment. Otherwise, if the affliction was judged to be such as to prevent work, a few days off could be granted. Later still, some blocks were used as infirmaries, which little by little grew larger with the establishment of new services, so that during our stay in the camp, the following wards functioned regularly: general practice outpatient clinic, general surgery outpatient clinic, otolaryngology and ophthalmology outpatient clinic, dermatology outpatient clinic, dental ward, in which fillings and the most basic prosthetic work were also performed, aseptic surgery, with attached otolaryngology section, septic surgery barracks, general medicine barracks with a section for nervous and mental diseases. This one was even equipped with a small electroshock therapy machine, infectious diseases and diarrhea barracks, and finally a so-called Schonungsblock, to which dystrophics, edematous and certain convalescents were admitted. The hospital also had a physical therapeutic barracks, with a quartz lamp for ultraviolet irradiation and a lamp for infrared irradiation, and a barracks for bacteriological and serological chemical research. There was no X-ray facility, and if a radiological examination became necessary, the sick were sent to Auschwitz, where there were good facilities, and whence they returned with the radiological diagnosis. From this description, one might assume that it was a hospital, small yes, but complete in almost every service and well functioning. In reality, there were many deficiencies, some perhaps insurmountable, such as the lack of medicines and the scarcity of dressing material, given the serious situation in which Germany was already even then, pressed on the one hand by the unstoppable advance of the Russian troops, and on the other by the daily bombardment by the Anglo-American air forces, but others could have been remedied with a little goodwill, organizing the services better. The first and most important of these deficiencies was the insufficiency in numbers and capacity of the premises. For example, there was a lack of a waiting room for the sick who went to the outpatient clinics, so that they were forced to stand in interminable queues in the open, during any season and in any weather, after having returned to camp in the evening, already fatigued by the long working day, since the outpatient clinics opened only after all the workers had returned to camp, or at the end of the evening roll call. Before entering the outpatient clinic, everyone had to take off his shoes, and was therefore obliged to walk barefoot on floors that, like that of the surgical clinic, were very filthy, due to the presence of used dressing material thrown on the floor, and consequently smeared with blood and pus. In the pavilions, the insufficient number of beds was very serious. The result was the need for each bed to serve two people, whatever the disease from which they were suffering and its severity. Therefore, the likelihood of transmitting diseases was very high, also taking into account the fact that, due to the lack of shirts, the sick in the hospital were without shirts. In fact, upon entering the hospital, each sick person handed all his clothing to the disinfection room. Blankets and bags were even filthy, with stains of blood and pus and often feces, which sick people in a pre-agonal state unintentionally shed. Hygienic rules were completely neglected, except for just enough to keep up appearances. Thus, for example, as there was a shortage of eating utensils, meals were served in two or more shifts, and the sick on the second or third shift were forced to eat soup in containers badly rinsed in cold water contained in a bucket. In the so-called Schonungsblock, there was no running water system, as on the other hand in all the other barracks, but while the inmates in the latter had the possibility of going to the washroom to wash whenever they felt like it, those admitted to the former could not enjoy such a possibility of washing, except once a day, in the morning, over 200 availing themselves in six basins, into which the nurses poured from time to time a liter of water, brought from outside in special barrels. In this same section, the bread was carried from the dressing room, where it was stored the night before, on top of a bench that, during the day, served the sick as a stool, to rest their feet on during dressings, at the end of which it was always smeared with blood and pus, from which it was quickly wiped off with a rag soaked in cold water. In order to be admitted to the hospital, the sick, recognized by the doctors of the outpatient clinic as worthy of admission, had to present themselves one more time the following morning, immediately after waking up, to undergo another examination, very hurriedly, by the medical director of health services. If these confirmed the need for hospitalization, they were directed to the shower room. There they had all their hair shaved, then they were showered, and finally, they were directed to the hospital ward they had been assigned to. To reach it, they had to walk out into the open air, badly covered with a single coat, and in this condition walk some 100 to 200 meters, during any season and in any weather and meteorological condition. Within the medical wards, the chief physician, aided by one or two nurses, spent the morning examination, without personally going to the bedside of each sick person, but it was the sick themselves who had to get out of bed and present themselves to him, excluding only those who were absolutely prevented from doing so by especially severe conditions. A quick counter visit was performed in the evening. In the surgery barracks, dressings were performed in the morning, and since the dormitory was divided into three wards, and each ward medicated in turn, it followed that each inpatient was medicated every third day. And since the dressings were fixed with only paper bandages, which in a few hours would tear and unravel, the wounds, aseptic or not, remained uncovered practically all the time. Only in rare cases and of special importance were dressings fixed with tape, which was used most sparingly because of its scarcity. Medicinal cures were reduced to a minimum. There was an absolute lack of many products, even of the simplest and most commonly used, while of others there were only meager quantities. There was a little aspirin, a little pyrimidon, a little prontosil, the only representative of the sulfamides, a little bicarbonate, a few vials of coramine and a few of caffeine. Missing were camphorate oil, strychnine, opium and all its derivatives, except small amounts of tincture. Similarly missing were belladonna and atropine, insulin, expectorants, as well as bismuth and magnesia salts, pepsin and hydrochloric acid, while purgatives and laxatives were represented by histazine alone. Instead, there were discrete amounts of hexamethylene tetramine, medicinal charcoal and tanalbine. Vials of calcium and any restorative preparations were also lacking. There was a fair amount of avipin sodium for intravenous use, and vials of ethyl chloride for narcosis. The latter was also widely used for minor procedures, such as the incision of a furuncle. Every now and then, the pharmaceutical cabinet was replenished by arriving inmates, as new convoys of inmates arrived in the camp, of different quantities of the most disparate products and the most diverse pharmaceutical specialties, many of them unusable, found in the suitcases confiscated from the new arrivals, but, on the whole, the need always remained far in excess of what was available. Personnel were recruited exclusively from among the deportees themselves. Doctors were chosen, after examination, from among those who, on entering the camp, had reported having a medical degree, with priority given to those who had mastered the German or Polish language. Their services were rewarded with better food and better clothing and footwear. Assistants and nurses, on the other hand, were chosen without any criteria of professional precedent. They were mostly individuals of considerable physical prowess, who obtained the position, naturally highly coveted, thanks to their friendships and relationships with doctors already in office, or with senior camp personnel. It followed that, while the doctors generally demonstrated a fair degree of competence and civility, the auxiliary personnel were distinguished by their ignorance, or disregard, of all hygienic, therapeutic and humanitarian norms. They went so far as to trade some of the soup and bread intended for the sick, in exchange for cigarettes, articles of clothing and other things. The sick were often beaten for trivial faults, the distribution of food was not carried out in a regular manner, and against sick people who were guilty of more serious misconduct, for example stealing bread, the immediate discharge of the offender from the hospital and his immediate return to work was enforced as punishment, after the administration of a certain number of lashes, mostly 25, on the back, administered with great energy with a rubber-coated cloth tube. Another kind of punishment was the obligation to remain for a quarter of an hour on top of a rather high stool, with a very narrow seat, on the tip of the toes, with the legs flexed on the thighs, and these flexed on the pelvis, and with the arms stretched horizontally forward at shoulder height. Usually, after a few minutes, the patient would lose his balance due to muscle fatigue and the general weakness of his body, and therefore would tumble to the ground, much to the amusement of the nurses, who would circle and mock him with jeers and mottos. The fallen man had to get up again and, having climbed back on the stool, resume his position for the stipulated time. If, due to subsequent falls, he was no longer able to do so, the remainder of the punishment was liquidated with a certain number of lashes. The influx of sick people was always very great, and exceeded the capacity of the various wards. Therefore, to make room for new arrivals, a certain number of sick people were discharged daily, even though they were incompletely cured, and always in a condition of serious general weakness. Nevertheless, they had to resume work the following day. Those then who were chronically ill, or whose stay in the hospital was prolonged beyond a certain period of time, which was around 2 months, were sent, as we have already reported for tuberculosis, Luetic and malaria patients, to Birkenau, and were there gassed. The same fate was suffered by those who, being too emaciated, were no longer able to work in the units. From time to time, about once a month, the so-called Muslim selection, by this picturesque term were called precisely those individuals who were extremely emaciated, was carried out in the various sections of the hospital, by which the most physically deteriorated were chosen and sent to the gas chambers. Such selections took place with great speed, and were carried out by the medical director of health services, before whom all the inmates had to parade naked, and with a superficial glance, he judged the general state of the individuals, and immediately decided their fate. A few days later, the chosen ones would undergo a second examination by an SS medical captain, who was the general manager of the health services of all the camps dependent on Auschwitz. For the sake of truth and justice, we must say that this visit was more meticulous than the previous one, and each case weighed and discussed. In any case, there were only a few lucky ones who were discarded and readmitted to the hospital for further treatment, or sent back to jobs in units whose work was not very strenuous. Most were sentenced to death. One of us was on the list of Muslims four times, and each time he escaped his mortal fate only thanks to the fact that he was a doctor. For doctors, we do not know whether by a general provision or by the initiative of the leadership of that camp, were spared such an end. In October 1944, the selection, instead of remaining limited to the infirmary halls, was extended to all blocks, but it was the last, for after that time, such a search was suspended, and the gas chambers at Birkenau then dismantled. However, on that tragic day, 850 victims had been selected and sent to the gas, including 8 Jews of Italian citizenship. The operation of the gas chambers and the attached crematorium was disengaged by a special unit, which worked day and night in 2 shifts. The members of this unit lived apart, carefully segregated from all contact with other inmates or the outside world. A nauseating smell emanated from their clothes. They were always dirty and looked absolutely savage, truly like ferocious beasts. They were chosen from the worst criminals convicted of serious blood crimes. We understand that in February 1943, a new, more suitable crematorium and gas chamber were inaugurated at Birkenau than those that had been in operation up to that month. They consisted of 3 parts: the waiting room, the shower room, and the furnaces. In the center of the furnaces stood a tall chimney, around which 9 furnaces with 4 openings each were grouped, and each of these allowed 3 corpses to pass through concurrently. The capacity of each furnace was 2,000 corpses per day. The victims introduced into the first room were ordered to undress completely, because they were to take a bath, and, to further credit the deception, they were handed a piece of soap and a towel, after which they passed into the shower room. This was a large chamber, in which was set up a posh shower facility, and on the walls of which stood out inscriptions to the effect that, "Wash yourselves well, for cleanliness is the health of the body. Do not economize on soap. Do not forget your towel here," so that the hall could give the illusion of really being in a large bathing establishment. On the flat ceiling of the room was a large opening, hermetically sealed by 3 large sheet metal plates, which opened like a valve. Rails ran across the entire width of the chamber, and led from it to the furnaces. When all the people had entered the gas chamber, the doors were closed, they were airtight, and a chemical preparation in the form of a coarse blue-gray powder, contained in tin cans, was thrown through the valves in the ceiling. These bore a label reading Zyklon B, for the destruction of animal pests, and the brand name of a Hamburg factory. This was a cyanide preparation, which evaporated at a certain temperature. Within minutes, all those locked up in the gas chamber died. Then, doors and windows were thrown wide open, and special command employees, equipped with masks, went into operation, transporting the corpses to the crematory furnaces. Before introducing the corpses into the furnaces, special appointees would shear the hair from those who still had it, namely, from the corpses of those persons who, as soon as they arrived by transport, had been immediately taken to the slaughterhouse, without entering the camps, and they would extract the gold teeth from those who had any. The ashes, as is well known, were then scattered over the fields and gardens, as fertilizer for the soil. Towards the end of 1944, a decree arrived at the Monowitz camp that all doctors present in the camp should be exempted from work in the units, and should be employed in the various hospital sections as doctors or, in the absence of positions, as nurses. Before being assigned to the new work, they were to practice in the various medical and surgical sections for the duration of a month, following a certain routine, and at the same time, they were to take a theory course on the sanitary organization of the concentration camps, their operation, the characteristic pathology of the camps, and the care to be given to the sick. These provisions were duly implemented, and the course was started in the first days of January 1945, but towards the middle of the same month, it was interrupted, given the overwhelming Russian offensive in the Krakow-Kotovets-Breslau direction, in the face of which the German armies resorted to hasty retreat. The Monowitz camp, like all the others in the Auschwitz region, was also ordered to evacuate, and the Germans dragged along about 11,000 deportees, who, according to reports received later from someone who miraculously escaped, were almost all slaughtered with machine guns a few days later, when the escorting soldiers had the feeling that they were completely surrounded by the Red Army and had no way out. They had already walked about 70 kilometers, almost without stopping, deprived of provisions. Those received before the departure from the camp consisted of 1 kilogram of bread, 75 grams of margarine, 90 grams of salami and 45 grams of sugar. Afterwards, they had been loaded onto several trains, which set off in different directions, but could not reach any destination. Then, the massacre of the survivors of such superhuman toil occurred. Many, perhaps 3,000 or 4,000, who had stopped agonizingly along the road, had already been slaughtered on the spot with pistol shots and rifle butts by the escorting soldiers. In the meantime, only 1,000 incapacitated, sick or convalescent inmates, unable to walk, were left in the camp under the surveillance of some SS men, who had received orders to shoot them before abandoning them. We do not know why the latter order was not carried out, but, whatever the reason, to this alone the undersigned owe their continued existence. They had been detained in the hospital, the one, De Benedetti, put in charge of medical care of the hospitalized, the other, Levy, because he was convalescing. The order to care for the sick could only be carried out morally, since material assistance was made impossible by the fact that the Germans, before leaving the camp, had cleared the hospital of every medicine and surgical instrument. Neither an aspirin tablet, nor a dressing forceps, nor a gauze pad could be found. Highly dramatic days followed. Many sick people died from lack of care, many from exhaustion, as food supplies were also lacking. There was also a shortage of water, the pipeline of which had been destroyed by an aerial bombardment in those very days. Only the fortuitous discovery of a potato storehouse, buried in an adjacent field to preserve them from frost, enabled the less weak to feed themselves, and hold out until the day when the Russians, who had finally arrived, generously provided the distribution of provisions. Unquote. Unfortunately, this report also presents many of the foibles of black testimonial propaganda: bread that contained wood sawdust, completely neglected hygienic rules, dressings with paper bandages, lack of running water, 200 inmates had to wash in 6 basins, bread laid, quote, on top of a bench that, during the day, served the sick as a stool, to rest their feet on during dressings, unquote, human ashes used as fertilizer. The description of the new crematorium allegedly inaugurated in February 1943 was blatantly plagiarized from the Werbar Wetzler report, included in the War Refugee Board report, submitted as a prosecution document during the IG Farben trial, which was elaborated with great imagination by 2 notorious imposters, who reworked the black propaganda created by the camp resistance, without even asking the inmates who worked in the crematoria. The story of periodic quote-unquote selections for the gas chamber, which made the hospital a very dangerous place, is in blatant contrast to the quote-unquote very large number of inmates reporting sick, who evidently did not fear anything. The machine gunning of about 11,000 deportees evacuated from Monowitz is pure fantasy, again in contrast to the survival of the sick, left by the SS in Monowitz, about 850, including De Benedetti and Levy themselves, although the camp's SS had, quote, received orders to shoot them before abandoning them. Unquote. Even the claim that prior to February 1944 there, quote, was no medical service, and the sick had no chance of treatment, but were forced to work equally every day, until they fell exhausted on the job, unquote, with all that follows, is patently false, as is evident from Makovsky's table I quoted above. Apart from these quote-unquote dutiful concessions to the black propaganda circulating at the time, their description of the structure and operation of the Monowitz inmate infirmary is basically honest and correct. A year after this text was written, Leonardo De Benedetti was a witness during the Hus trial, where he gave a brief deposition at the 11th hearing on the 22nd of March 1947. I reproduce a translation of the essential part of his testimony, quote, I stayed in this camp for 11 months. The Italians almost all died, only 8 of them returned home. The work we performed was very heavy, especially the winter work. The workday was long, because the work started at 7 a.m. and lasted until 6 p.m. During this time, we did not eat anything. They would only give us beet soup and cabbage, besides that, almost nothing. They did not give us bread. Almost all the inmates suffered from diarrhea. This diarrhea was the consequence of poor nutrition, due to lack of vitamins and other nutrients. Many died as a result of this diarrhea, which had a very rapid course. There were also many cases of infectious diseases, such as diphtheria, scarlet fever, typhoid fever, and even cases of pneumonia. The sick were not treated. There was a sick room, but there was no medicine. Those seriously ill were gassed. The slightly ill preferred to continue working, lest they show up at the sick room, since the sick very often ended up at the crematorium. Many sick people had swellings and abscesses on their legs. I myself have a scar from an abscess on my legs that can still be seen. I personally was selected 4 times, but because I was a doctor, 4 times I was excluded from the group destined for the crematorium, because doctors were not gassed, I don't know why. In the course of these 11 months, I saw 14 hangings. They, the inmates, were hanged for attempting to escape. The executions always took place in a solemn manner. After evening roll call, after work, or on Sundays. Often, a punitive roll call was carried out at night, lasting 2, 3, and even 5 hours. The inmates did not even know what the reason was for these punitive roll calls. It was only said that these were punitive roll calls, but the reason was never given. We had to wait in the night block for this punitive roll call. I can provide the names of the Italians who were gassed. Selections were made in this way: the doctor would choose the most emaciated in the sick room. The next day, those who had been chosen were presented to the camp's most senior doctor. A couple of days later, the senior doctor would present these sick people to the camp's senior SS Captain Mengele, meaning Mengele, who would make the final selection. The selection, which at first took place only in the sick room, later took place in the work blocks as well. The weakest, oldest people, who were about 50 years old, were of course selected. There were no people over 50 years old. Selections were always made from among the oldest or youngest people, if they were sick. Until August of 1944, selection took place almost exclusively in the sick room. In the following months, both in the sick room and in the work barracks, the last selection took place in October 1944. On that day, 800 inmates were selected, among whom were Italians. Unquote. In this superficial and coarse testimony, De Benedetti bowed slavishly to the propaganda spirit of the trial. His deposition is less than a parody of his report of the year before. The articulate and well-structured Monowitz hospital became a mere sick room, and he did not even resist the lure of protagonism. In the report he had stated, quote, "One of us was on the list of Muslims 4 times, and each time he escaped his mortal fate only thanks to the fact that he was a doctor. For doctors, we do not know whether by a general provision or by the initiative of the leadership of that camp, were spared such an end." Unquote. In the deposition, this indeterminate person became himself, quote, "I personally was selected 4 times, but because I was a doctor, 4 times I was excluded from the group destined for the crematorium, because doctors were not gassed, I don't know why." Unquote. As mentioned earlier, De Benedetti reported sick and was hospitalized 3 times in the inmate infirmary, in the period from the 11th of March through the 28th of July 1944. He spent a total of 129 days there, but despite this, he dared to utter this shameless lie, quote, "Those seriously ill were gassed. The slightly ill preferred to continue working, lest they show up at the sick room, since the sick very often ended up at the crematorium." Unquote. Primo Levi stayed there 21 days, from the 30th of March to the 20th of April 1944, NI 10186, page 360, running number 21669. In his undeservedly famous memoir, he told the story of this hospitalization, which was due to a work accident to his left foot, seasoning it with the trite themes of testimonial legends, Levi 1948, page 55, quote, "Carbe is short for Krankenbau, the infirmary. There are 8 barracks, similar in every way to the others in the camp, but separated by a fence. They permanently contain 1/10 of the camp's population, but few stay there more than 2 weeks, and none more than 2 months. Within these timeframes, we are required to either die or recover. Those who have a tendency to recover are cured in the car bay. Those who have a tendency to get worse are sent from the car bay to the gas chambers. Unquote. He was therefore one of the lucky few who stayed there longer than 2 weeks, Ibidem, page 69, quote. After 20 days of car bay, my wound having practically healed, to my great regret I was discharged. Unquote. Note the words, to my great regret.